Hello and welcome. You're listening to podcast cast 4 for the lecture on propositional logic. We resume on slide 51. So let's look at another example for the DPLL algorithm. So we are given a knowledge base as shown in the first line, and you can see that this knowledge base contains a unit clause S. So we need to satisfy all clauses in our knowledge base. So it's very obvious that S must be true. So we can just apply unit propagation here. Now, we would have satisfied all clauses which contain S as well. However, we do not have any such clauses left. But we have three clauses which contain not S. So as S is true, not S is false, and it means that the remaining literals in these clauses, one of them at least must be true. So we remove actually not S from these clauses and obtain the knowledge base as shown in the second line. So this fortunately leads again to two more unit clauses. So we have R and Q left. So again, these two literals must be true. So we decide to first make Q true. And then in the next step, we make R true. So now, after each of these assignments, we can then again conclude on how this affects the other clauses. So if we set Q to true, then not Q is false. So this means that one literal in the clause P or not R must be true. Furthermore, the literal not P must be true. So this leads us to the representation of the clauses in the third line. So now again, we have a unit clause left not P, and we have a clause left P or not R, and the unit clause R. Definitely we need to make R true, but we also had to make not P true, which would make P false, and also not R false. So we have now seen a number of unit propagation steps which were definitely enforced because we have these unit clauses which we make true, but unfortunately this finally leads to a contradiction. So when we set R to true, then not R is false, so P must be definitely true, but at the same time we must make the other clause not P true, which is impossible. So now we can actually derive the empty clause, and we know that our knowledge base is unsatisfiable because we do not find such an satisfying truth assignment. Here in this case we could only show this by applying simple unit propagation steps. We did not need to make any case distinction by applying the splitting rule and then investigating all the cases. So now the question is unit propagation sound and complete? It is sound. So if we can derive a transformed knowledge base from our original knowledge base by unit propagation, then actually this knowledge base, this transformed knowledge base, is entailed by the original knowledge base. So we only go from valid statements or sentences to valid sentences. So this is easy to show because any derivation we make by unit propagation can also be made by the full resolution rule, and we know already that this has the soundness property. However, we cannot show that unit propagation is complete, because for completeness we needed to show that if there is any transformed knowledge base, then unit propagation can actually generate this knowledge base. This is not the case, because unit propagation only makes very limited inferences because it needs these unit clauses. It does not guarantee to infer everything that can be inferred from our knowledge base. So if we arrive at a situation where no unit propagation is possible anymore, we have seen that we actually then have to apply the splitting rule. So just unit propagation alone cannot derive everything that is possible and is incomplete. So, for example, there is a set of clauses shown here. This set of clauses is unsatisfiable, but you can convince yourself easily that by unit propagation alone you cannot derive the empty clause. So the completeness of DPLL actually is coming from the splitting rule. Yeah? We showed already that resolution is refutation complete on formulas in clausal normal form. So if a set of clauses in clausal normal is unsatisfiable, then resolution will actually derive the empty clause. This result is the basis for the completeness proof of DPLL. If we can deduce the empty clause by applying resolution, then actually DPLL deduces an unsatisfiable clause normal form. If we keep applying resolution until no more applications of resolutions are possible, then our algorithm will deduce satisfiable conjunctive normal clause normal form. If no resolution step is possible anymore, then the splitting rule performs a complete case analysis of possible interpretations. This either enables further resolution steps until we obtain an interpretation for all Boolean variables. And or we arrive at the empty clause in all possible cases, and then we actually see that our original formula is unsatisfiable. So what is interesting about DPLL is that it exploits chronological backtracking. So at each branching step in the algorithm, it decides for a variable, and it then selects a choose value for this. And of course, in our logic, we have only two values that can be assigned, either 0 or 1. So our algorithm decides on one value, and then it evaluates the logical consequences of this assignment. We've seen this on the previous example. In one case, for example, we arrived at the empty clause. So this is a conflict. Now we've seen that we've made a choice of truth value assignments that leads to a logical contradiction. So now the algorithm actually backtracks and unders its choices, and it considers the other branches. So when all these branches have yielded a conflict, then of course we know that the formula is unsatisfiable. The question is if we can backtrack in a smarter way. So once we've identified a conflict, can we somehow learn something from this conflict that allows us to find a satisfying assignment faster, or that allows us to faster find out that our formula is unsatisfiable? This leads us now to an approach that is called conflict-driven clause learning. Before we introduce this, let's further look into how the variables and clauses that contain these variables can be further analyzed. So let's consider the following example. We have given a formula phi with three different clauses called omega 1, omega 2, omega 3. So you see the variables in these clauses. Each clause is a disjunction of these variables. So now let's assume we are at the first iteration of our algorithm and we make a choice. So we assign x4 the value 0, which means x4 is false. Here we have no unit clauses or pure literals available, so we actually have to make this choice to proceed further. So now we add x4 to true, and this makes not x4 false. No, sorry, of course we make x4 false, which makes not x4 true. So now we cannot conclude anything else. x1 could be, for example, either true or false to satisfy the first clause, because not x4 is true, and with that the clause is already for true. Now let's assume we make another choice to set x1 to false. Unit propagation now yields an implied assignment. So if we decide to make x1 false, then this means that x3 and the second clause must be true. We do not need to consider the first clause anymore because we know already that with not x4 being set to true, we don't really care about the value of x1 in this clause. So we remove that clause from consideration. However, for the clause x1 or x3 in the middle, we have to make a choice. So here now we decide we set x1 to false, which means that x3 must be true. With that, not x3 is actually set to false. And as x4 is already false, it also immediately follows that x2 must be true. So now we can talk systematically about the decision levels where we actually decide which variable takes which truth value. And we also have antecedents of variables. So certain variables and their truth values are actually implied by earlier choices and antecedent formulas. So x3, for example, is implied by the antecedent omega 2. So because in this formula actually forced us to set x3 to true. X2 is implied by the antecedent omega 3 because we concluded about its truth value from looking at this formula. So SAT checkers or SAT solvers actually exploit these dependencies of assignments and enforced truth values. So on slide 56, I want to give you the basic idea. So let's assume we have a special node K, which represents the unsatisfied clause. And now these are our vertices, so all aside variables. And in the end, we have, for example, derived this conflict in the special node K. Now we have we draw actually edges. So we do look at the antecedents of all these assigned variables. Yeah, if we have an antecedent omega for variable xi, then we put a directed edge from each variable in omega other than xi to xi. If unit propagation yields an unsatisfied clause omega I, then there's a special vertex and a directed edge from omega I to our empty clause k. So this, for example, in our example can look like this. So at level 2, we made the decision to set x1 to false. And then with these two clauses, omega 2 and omega 3, we could actually derive through unit propagation at the truth values for x3 and x2 at the same inference level. So let's look at a specific situation in such a SAT solver. So here we have an implication graph with conflict. So we see a snapshot on the inferences drawn by the solver. So we actually look at what happens at level 3. So let's look at some choice literals. So we decided, for example, to make the variable x3, 1 false and also set x1 to false. And we did this in different inference levels. By looking at the formulas omega 1 and omega 2, this actually leads then to some further settings of implied truth values at level 5. So x2 is set to false, x3 is set to false. This again with the formulas omega 3 allows us to conclude that x4 must be 1. And also with for clause omega 4, we then actually conclude that formula or that literal x5 must be false. So now let's assume that at some earlier level in this reasoning or implication graph of this subchecker. So we've actually decided to set the variable x to 1 to false. So with the formula of omega 5, this now actually means, together with the assignment of x4 at level 5 to set to true, we get this implied value of x5 set to false. And now this actually also means that x6 must be false as well. When you look at the formula 5, you see that x21 occurs there. It is false. X4, we've actually just found out at level 5 that x4 is true, so not x4 is also false. So not x6 must actually be true, which means that x6 itself must be false. And now we actually see that we have arrived at the empty clause, because as x5 and x6 are both now set to false, we will not have a chance to satisfy this last remaining clause omega 6. So this is now unfortunately a conflict, and the formula or the clause omega 6 now leads to this edge k, which represents this conflict or the empty clause. And now the interesting insight is that we can actually look again at these choices and learn that the set of choices we've made was not a good idea. So how is this being done? Let's look at slide 58. So in this specific example, we are at decision level 5, and we now have this conflict K, and we have our implication graph. So we have certain implied variables where we actually, by unit propagation, found out what their truth value is. The choice variables are at the root of this implication graph that leads to the conflict cause. And these choices are actually the cause of the conflict. So our choice was x31 is false, x1 is false, and x21 is also false. So the choice of setting all these three variables to false is actually not a good idea. So how can we actually now register this conflict? So we can construct a new formula. So we know that, and we do this as a conjunction. So we know that not x31 and not x21 and not x1, because all three are false, is a conflict. So to avoid this conflict, we should make the negation of this formula true. So now we put a negation sign in front. We move negation inwards. Double negation can be removed. And now we actually see that we learn a new clause, x31 or x21 or x1. This is a new clause which must be true. So we must make one of these variables true. Which one, we don't know, but at least we know that setting the combination of all three to false was a bad idea. So now we take this learned clause, add it to our knowledge base, and this helps us to avoid certain truth value assignments. And maybe if we've learned a short clause, then we can actually also do more unit propagation. Let's look at another example on slide 60. So here again, we see a set of clauses. Let's assume we make a choice. So we have no pure symbols here. Oh no, actually we have one. So now, actually there is this pure symbol P. So if you look carefully at the clauses, you see that P only occurs in negated form in each of these clauses. So you can make the clause or every clause true by assigning not P the value true. So make P false. And with this, we actually are done, because now we set P to false, not P is true. This makes any disjunction true, and with this the entire formula set is true. So it doesn't even matter what truth values we assign to Q and R. So, but to look a little bit at conflict learning, let's assume we make a less smarter choice. And you see here actually how effective this pure symbol heuristic actually is. But let's assume we don't know this heuristic and we've decided to make P true instead of not P. And let's also assume we set Q to the value of true. So this leads then to the truth values that you see depicted in blue below the clauses. So we get actually two clauses, the first two ones. With these settings, only the literal R is left, but it's less, it is left in, as in a positive occurrence and also in a negative occurrence. However, to make now these first two clauses true simultaneously, we now have to set R and not R to true, which leads to the conflict K. So now we can actually learn another clause. So we know that P and Q made true at the same time is not a good idea. So we take P and Q as both truth values. We negate now that this, this clause, and it means that we add a new learned clause P, Q to our clause set. So we learn this clause not P and Q. We move negation inward. And this leads then directly to the new clause not P or not Q. This prevents that both values are set to true at the same time. So conflict-driven clause learning is the basis for a very efficient set-checking algorithm called CDCL, and it's summarized on slide 61. So unit propagation happens as in the DPLL algorithm. The conflict analysis adds the new learned clause to our clause set, and it also returns the backtracking decision level and backtracks then actually backtracks back to this given decision level. So we don't want to go into depths of this algorithm, but it gives you an idea also from the previous examples that we very effectively can then find satisfying truth value assignments or find out that the clause set is unsatisfiable. So by exploiting the CDCL algorithm, we actually avoid the chronological backtracking that is done in Davis-Putnam. So we learn the new clause, and when we keep the implication graph, we can immediately backtrack to the level where the cause of a conflict occurred and undo some of our choices. So we've seen that DPLL is a sound and complete algorithm for satisfiability checking, and CDCL actually implement DPLL. So they can, in addition, learn new clauses and backtrack non-chronologically. Clause learning with conflict analysis does not affect soundness or completeness of an algorithm. Conflict analysis identifies new clauses during resolution, and each learned can therefore be inferred from the original set of clauses. And also other learned clauses can always be derived by a sequence of resolution steps. And as we know that resolution is sound, every clause that we add through conflict-driven clause learning is in fact sound and entailed by all our knowledge base. However, this entailed clause was not, let's say, explicit or could not be seen in a very obvious way in this clause set. And that's why we actually need to make it explicit. So adding then more clauses constrains the possible truth values of the propositional variables, and this allows SAT solvers that we have today to scale so well. There are other techniques exploited that make SAT solvers so powerful tools today. Slide 63 summarizes some of these ideas. So when we assign truth values to variables, it can happen that the set of clauses becomes separated into disjoint subsets, and we call these subsets components. They do not share any unassigned variables, so this means now finding assignments to these remaining variables can happen completely independently of each other. So now the solver can work on each component separately, and this also means that we can, for example, have parallelization in this work on the components. Furthermore, you've already seen that there might be some clever techniques to decide which propositional variable to assign next. So we've simply picked something, but you can imagine that a clever selection strategy, which variable you assign next and what value you first consider, can actually help you a lot in quickly arriving, for example, at conflicts and then learning these conflicts. And there's a so-called degree heuristic that, for example, suggests to select the variable that appears most frequently over all remaining clauses. You can easily imagine why this is a good idea. So this is a variable that contains in many, many clauses. No other variable is contained in more clauses. So this means that the value of this variable, once we set it, will of course also have an impact on all these clauses. And this can of course give us more chances, for example, to do unit propagation or rule out a large number of clauses that we've already seen as being true. Then, of course, clever indexing is always a good idea. So have very well thought through data structures to find variables or clauses quickly. You can imagine if you have knowledge bases with millions of clauses, how you represent this knowledge base and how you maintain the implication graph makes a big difference. And SAT solvers today also use a technique that we have already seen when we looked at local search algorithm, namely random restarts. So when we make no progress and we just get somehow lost in these millions of propositional variables, we always have to make choices and so on, but we can't really do effective propagation, then it may actually be a good idea to start over. But we should not forget what we have learned, because any learned clauses, as we said, could also be derived from resolution. So it makes sense to really keep them and add them to the knowledge base. So with this, I want to summarize the lecture on propositional logic. So propositional reasoning seems to be very simple, because we only consider these Boolean variables and in fact construct rather simple formulas over them, but propositional reasoning plays a very important role today in these SAT solvers at which we looked a little bit, and in so-called OMT solvers. OMT solvers are SAT solvers which can actually also solve optimization problems. They not only look for a satisfying truth assignment, but they also look for an assignment that has, for example, makes a maximum number of variables true, and that's why they can also solve optimization problems. We use SAT checking for all kinds of decision problems and also, for example, to verify that systems have certain properties. And we can, in fact, represent very complex problems because we simply use millions of variables or even more. So this is, of course, something that humans don't write by hand. You usually have a much more compact representation, for example, in the form of predicate logic, which you will learn about next. And then we can use a technique that's called grounding, instantiate all predicate logic formulas and arrive at propositional formulas. And then we feed these formulas into SAT solvers. Yeah, resolution, DPLL, and clause learning are very important algorithms that are used in these modern solvers. We looked at them. I think you could also understand the basic ideas, how they work. And the important things to remember is that resolution by itself is not complete, DPLL is complete, and clause learning only learns clauses that are implied by the knowledge base and could also be derived by resolution. Of course, there are limits of logical reasoning, and these, for example, result from inherent uncertainty in the domain. So we looked at the Wumpus world to understand a little bit how we can proceed with logical reasoning to derive safe actions, but look at the situation depicted in the right. So our agent enters the cave and now it notices a breeze. So now the agent is actually stuck. So because it cannot conclude anymore that the two neighboring cells that it has are safe. So the pit can be in one of these cells, and now our agent faces a risk of death that is at 50%. So we will not look in detail how we can actually also do some reasoning in the light of uncertainty in this lecture, but you can of course imagine that this is a very important field of research for AI. And some of this will be touched upon a little bit by Professor Hoffmann. So slide 65 summarizes the working questions for you. You should really be able to understand the syntax and semantics of propositional logics, and also understand how you can construct well-formed logical formulas and how you can derive the truth value of a formula. We've introduced certain terminology that we use to talk about syntactic and semantic properties of logical formulas. Look at the slides, also read the book, and put together for you also a catalog of these important terms. We learned about two normal forms for propositional logic formulas, disjunctive normal form and conjunctive normal form, and from conjunctive normal form we derived clause normal forms. So are you able, given any logical formula, can you compute these normal form representations for this formula? We looked at resolution, so take some examples of logical formulas and apply the resolution rule to a set of clauses. Then look again at the description of the DPLL algorithm and understand what unit propagation does and what the splitting rule does and how these two essential techniques work. And you should also be able to explain the key idea behind clause learning and why it does help a solver in finding a satisfiable interpretation faster or concluding that no such interpretation exists. Thank you very much. With this last podcast, I want to end the lecture on propositional logic.